You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Jack, tell me a story.
What a fucking week, am I right? I hope you're well. I have a small cold, but don't worry. I'll be all right. I'll be fine. I'm home, quarantined, as are you, I'm assuming. So happy fucking Sunday, folks. I hope you're doing okay. Today, I talk to music scene legend, and all-around gentleman Michael Ilago. We tell stories you're probably not expecting to hear on this podcast. Just a heads up, this episode is not about musical theater. It is about music, though. Did you think that this whole podcast was musical theater?
Surprise, motherfucker.
It's about storytelling, and this guy has a lot of stories. If you're a fan of music, which is literally everyone in the world, you will adore him as much as I do. You can stream the documentary on his life on Netflix called Who the Fuck Is That Guy? I didn't make that up. That is literally the title of the documentary. It totally makes sense. He's amazing. On March 25th, Amazon is releasing his memoir that you can actually pre-order right now. I have already pre-ordered it. It's called I Am Michael Ilago, Breathing Music, Signing Metallica, Beating Death. His journey is extraordinary. He doesn't even go into all of it in this podcast, which is why you have to buy his book, which is why you have to watch his documentary. But here's just a little taste, a little morsel of Michael Ilago. I just have to tell you before I guess we like get into all this that Anne, a friend of yours, a friend of mine, was like, you gotta watch this documentary. And I was like, okay, sure, because I do love documentaries. And she goes, no, you gotta watch it like now. So literally the next day.
Thank you, Anne.
Anne is the greatest.
Fabulous.
And she made me watch it, and I sat at home, and my husband was gone, and I watched it, and then I watched it again, and then I watched it again, all in the same night. I think I watched it like 3 times. And it's called Who the Fuck Is That Guy? And it's
The Fabulous Journey of Michael Ilago.
The Fabulous Journey of Michael Ilago. I appreciate that it's not the journey of Michael Ilago. It is a fabulous journey.
Oh, no, everything is fabulous to me. So I had to tell the director that word just kind of sort of has to be in there.
Yeah, it
and it is.
You are
and
fabulous.
It works.
Yeah, and then so what happened is I sent it to my mom, and then I sent it to my uncle, and then I started sending it out because I said, you guys have to watch this. Because it's not immediately coming up on our Netflix queues, and it bothers me because it should. And so I sent it to my mom, and then my mom FaceTimed me to watch. I wanted to watch my family watch your documentary. You know when you get excited about
of
a movie
course.
and you want to watch them watch it, and you're like, hey, this part. Oh, you're going to love this part. And it's like you're ruining it, but who cares? So I got to do that with my family, and they were really into it.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Yeah. I was amazed, and I just think it's so perfect that you're coming out with a book component to mm-hmm. this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think... Are there things in the book that aren't in the documentary?
Oh, gosh, there's so many things. Yeah. You know, we felt like Drew Stone, who's mm-hmm. the director of the film, and Michael Alex, the producer, we knew we just didn't want it to be about music.
Okay.
You know, it really had to be about a life.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't want to make like a 3-hour documentary either. So I think we kind of whittle it down to about 88 minutes.
Okay.
And it's about my 25 years in the music business as an A&R executive and the artists that I have either signed or A&R'd.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about addiction and recovery. And it talks about having being HIV positive and in the early 90s having full-blown AIDS. And in the end, you know, all this sex, drugs, and rock and roll would have been cliche if I died. But I didn't die.
Yeah.
So it's not a cliche. It's just, that's the story of my life.
It's just reality.
So, the great part about this, and it really is a blessing, is that we were telling everybody about the film, and then at one point Netflix approached us and wanted to put the film on Netflix. Well, that day in 2017 changed the face of that doc for us
mm-hmm.
because it was worldwide.
Yeah.
And I think a day or two later, I got about 1,200 emails from people saying, oh my God, I just watched your documentary. I loved it. Now, some of those people were just all excited about Metallica. Of course.
I was going to say, well, of course, I'm sure they were just like metalheads.
Yes, the biggest thing I've ever worked on, right. Signed. And the other things were people talking about, alcoholism and various forms of addiction and various forms of recovery.
Right.
And sometimes even people mentioned to me their HIV status. And I felt like so honored because I told the truth in my movie. And when you tell the truth, people respond to that.
Yeah.
So like, I tell this same little story a lot. There was a kid, 21 years old, and he says, I live in Colombia with my dad and I have HIV. And if I ever told my father, I think he would murder me. So now there are all those people who wrote to me about Metallica. So I didn't really send them back a form letter, but they got basically back the same email that, thank you so much. I love that you appreciate the movie and share it with all your friends.
Yeah.
And I usually would attach a picture of me and James Hetfield, the singer.
Amazing.
And they loved that. And the other people who talked to me about other issues, like I had just mentioned, you can't just write back and say, oh, thanks for watching the movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not here to give advice or anything, but all I could do was let some of these people who were hurting or who found out that they were positive, I just let them know what I did to keep myself as healthy as possible. You know, I stopped drinking and drugging. Mm-hmm. When the doctor said, take this, I took that, and just kind of willed myself into healthiness.
Wow.
So all that to say, just now, here we are, it's January 2020, and we just got a message from Netflix that they're extending the movie yet again to September 2020. So it's going to be almost 3 years that it's on the network.
Wow.
And it's like, it's unheard of. Usually,
yes.
Nothing lasts that long.
Right.
But I guess the response that they get is that powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So within that time frame, there was a small company called Backbeat Books, and they approached me, and they approached my agent, Lee Sobel, and he wanted to know if I wanted to make a book. And I thought, sure, I want to make a book.
Why not?
The ego prevails, and I want to make a book. So I have a co-writer. Her name is Laura Davis Channon. And I have a co-writer because I don't think I could have done it on my own because I'm a bit of a scatterbrain. And from all the drink and the drugs, my full brain didn't come back like I wanted it to. Coupled with all this white matter in my brain, which is called HIV encephalopathy, which screws with your memory.
Oh, wow.
So I do have problems with memory. But as a kid, I kept journals from when I was 15 years old. Now, those journals were not creative writing, but it was like 8 o'clock, took the train from Brooklyn, 10 o'clock, arrived at Seabees, midnight, left Seabees to go walk up Park Avenue to Max's Kansas City. So for years, it was just a list of everything I did as a young person until it did get creative.
Right.
So it became creative writing and or poetry. And
Between
my co-writer and these journals that I kept up until right this very minute, that helped me make the book.
Wow.
So it's very exciting. I'm very excited about the book.
Well, so are we. So,
oh, good.
Like, yay.
And just FYI, yes. I'm sorry, because I sometimes go off on a tangent.
No.
Right now, it's available on Amazon.com as a pre-order. And it's called I Am Michael Alago. And the subtitle is Breathing Music, Signing Metallica, Beating Death. All appropriate for my life.
All appropriate, and also all things that I would want to read about simultaneously.
Oh, cool. Uh-huh.
So it's like, okay, they're all in one book. I'll just take the book. So you can just pre-order it now.
And absolutely.
Which is easy. So we
and you
can
know what
tell people to do that.
Kind
now.
Of fun that Laura and I noticed that as we were working on the book, it came out like short stories.
Oh.
I didn't plan on that, but it just, I don't know, it just came out like short stories.
Nice.
So at the beginning of the book, if you read about Brooklyn, you kind of know what you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into the book and you see this chapter, Never Fall in Love with a Hooker, you kind of know what you're going to get. You know, so it's all things that if you even just, you know, because sometimes people don't have the patience anymore to read a book, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But if you did want to go to the fifth chapter, the eighth chapter, and you want to go to Gratitude or Brooklyn or The Ritz, it's all those chapters are complete thoughts. Mm. But of course, I would like people to go from the beginning to the end of the book, and it's very exciting.
But you can pick it up and say, like, okay, I'm going to read this chunk, and then I'm going to put it down, and then I can read this chunk and learn something.
And it kind of makes it easier on the audience, on the reader. Fair. Which, great.
Yeah.
If that helps you.
A lot of times, wonderful. Even like we're on the train and we're like, oh, I got to pick this up and then put it back down and pick it up and put it down. We don't live in Connecticut where we can sit with a crocheted blanket all the time and have our tea on our porch and then, you know, have an 8-hour reading session.
Correct.
That's not my life. And I don't think it's yours either.
I got to take a second and tell y'all about my personal training coaches, Steve and Rachel Payne at House of Payne. I've been doing their workout programs, let's say 3 years, and they shape bodies. And yes, they prepare people to compete in bodybuilding shows, which some of it's your jam. It's not my jam. What I love about them is that they understand the look that I want. Tone, fit, something that's sustainable for my lifestyle. They create a custom individual plan that includes my workouts, my cardio, and my nutrition. I do their online program, but when I'm in Atlanta, I do one-on-one training with them at their facility, and it kicks my ass. They FaceTime me whenever I have questions, alter my plan when needed, and no matter what stage you want to step on, competition, career, lifestyle, a red carpet, wedding, whatever it is, House of Payne personal training is the most personal training you can get. Visit their website, Train with Payne, TRAIN with PAYNE.com for more details.
I guess I can just start asking you, like, can you tell me a story of one of your earliest memories of seeing shows? Because you started so early.
Yeah.
It's crazy because I think, oh, you're in your 20s starting to go see rock shows.
No.
That's not you at all.
No, I was 13.
Yeah.
Yeah. Me and my mom and my sister went to visit my Aunt Bobby, my mom's younger sister. Mm. And her daughter, Carol Ann, was home. And she had a boyfriend who we fondly called Manny the Greek from Astoria. And Manny just happened that day to come over to the house. Mm-hmm. And he said to Carol Ann, I have 2 tickets for Alice Cooper at Madison Square Garden. Do you want to go? She said, no, I have my period. I'm going to stay home and listen to Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. But my 13-year-old cousin would probably want to go to the show. So I had never been to a concert before. I had seen Alice Cooper on Don Kirshner's In Concert. Mm-hmm. I'd seen Alice Cooper on various music television shows, and I knew I wanted to go. So it was the following day. So I went to see Manny. I think he worked in the men's division of Saks Fifth Avenue. And I went to his office, and we went down to Madison Square Garden together. It was June 3rd, 1973, and it was my first concert ever. So seeing the Alice Cooper and the theatricality
of
the show, as a 13-year-old, it just blew me away.
Yeah.
You know,
that's magic. The
high heel boots, the leopard skin high heel boots, the top hat, you know, the theatrical makeup he had on. And those songs were extraordinary. So that really was the beginning of my love for knowing that I wanted to go to concerts all the time.
Wow. That's your first experience. Your first experience.
Absolutely.
It's so far beyond anyone else's first concert experience. It's probably why you loved it so much, because it was just crazy unreal. Like, I think my first concert was Hootie and the Blowfish, so I can't relate to your concert.
A little different.
It's a little different. But anyways, it's just so neat. Like, my dad grew up in Atlanta playing bars, like a guitar, was like a studio musician type guy. But like your age, you know what I'm saying? Like 13, 14 was playing in bars where he should not have been, you know? And so he would always have these stories like, hey, I remember when Kiss came through and they weren't anybody, and then they signed my guitar and then I sold it because I was like, they're not that talented. Like, there's, and I'm like, oh my God, you idiot. But, you know, there's all these times of like when you're young and you would just go, and I don't know that young people just go anymore, and I want them to just go.
Well, you know, it was a very different time period where a lot of the young people I know, for some reason, we had no fear. I have no idea why. We just had no fear. We just all wanted to go where the music was being played.
Yeah.
And we just went.
Yeah.
And we had no fear that in 1976, the Bowery was a very scary place.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were homeless all over the place. There were drugs everywhere. Mm-hmm. All of the local bodegas sold drugs. Besides beer and soda and whatever else they sold.
Yeah.
Bologna. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was just a thing. We had no fear.
That's
and we
amazing.
Just went. We got on the train, most of us from Brooklyn. Uh-huh. We got into the city and we just ran.
It's crazy to think about.
So it's a different time period because New York now, I think people are more isolated than ever because of, you know, as well as technology being our friend, it also is a thing that it keeps people isolated as well.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to see something, music, sometimes they say to their friend, go to YouTube and see that new artist. Meanwhile, back in the day, if we heard about a new artist because we read The Village Voice, we got on the train to go see him or her or the group that we wanted to see. So I don't know where we're going with any of this.
Doesn't even matter. It's just I like that we're even addressing any of it. So
sure.
It's fine.
So anyway, back in the 70s, we were fearless.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's the thing is like I just like to go do things because where I grew up was a small town. So whenever I would see something coming or there was a show, that might be my only opportunity for the next 2 months. So I'm going to go.
Right.
And it blows my mind when I'm up here and I'm like pulling teeth to get people to come do things or see things with me. And I just go, what else you got? Mm-hmm. Like, what else is there to live for? Like, I just like to see performances, perform myself, like whatever it is. And it was a different time, but I just hope that maybe because of all of this isolation, it will force people to get back into that.
Oh, one would hope. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I live on positivity and hope because I can't.
I live on faith and hope and love.
Yeah.
You know? I just don't want it to be any other way. Mm-hmm. And I'm not Pollyanna or anything like that. But, you know, it's like a domino effect. I think if you spread love, it can only be helpful.
Yeah. What bad can come from those good things?
Right.
Can you, because I know that you probably have a million, but can you tell me a story about a show that changed your life? Like, when you saw this show, you were like, I want to do that thing. Hmm. Maybe not be on stage, but be a part of that thing.
Sure. Well, you know, I tell people a lot, I felt like I came out of the womb loving music. You know, at 14 years old, I knew because I had seen so many television shows about music, like Dick Clark's American Bandstand, Don Cornelius' Soul Train, Don Kirshner's In Concert. Those three shows alone had such a variety of artists on there, from David Bowie to Aretha Franklin, that it broadened at an early age, it broadened my listening. And 77 WABC radio, AM radio.
Mm.
I'm a little long-winded here, but there were so many shows that changed my life. Like I mentioned, Alice Cooper, because it was the very first concert ever.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the later concerts, 84, I am now an A&R person at Elektra Records. It's my first gig as an A&R executive. At first, I have no idea what A&R means, so I have to ask people. And the chairman of Elektra Records was very, very kind to me, and he allowed me to listen in on his telephone conversations. And his telephone conversations were to publishers and lawyers and managers and artists. So to answer your question now, finally, I guess one of the shows that changed my life forever was seeing Metallica for the first time. When I saw them, I knew that I really did know that they were going to be huge. I loved the energy. I loved that all four young people on stage were wildly charismatic. I was totally crazy about their singer, James Hetfield. Mm-hmm. I always tell people, he has beautiful teeth. And they think, like, this one's crazy. So, you know, James is a natural-born ringleader on stage. He knows how to whip an audience into a frenzy so that people just stay with them throughout the whole show. Mm-hmm. So when I saw Metallica, I think for the first time in 1982 at L'Amour in Brooklyn with my friend Phil Cavano, who then was in Shrapnel, but now plays in Monster Magnet. And then lots of stuff happened. And in summer of 84, when I got to see Metallica with Anthrax and Raven at Roseland on West 57th Street, which as a venue doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately, that changed my life forever. And I knew that I had to sign them to Elektra. And so the next day they came to my office, I ordered Chinese food and beer, and I felt like they never left the office. And that signing changed the landscape of rock and roll. Yeah. It changed how people were listening to new metal. And all the other record executives wanted their own brand of Metallica. Now, that doesn't happen very often, you know. Mm-hmm. But everyone wound up finding something great that worked for their label, whether it was Slayer, whether it was Megadeth. Well, Slayer are my second favorite band ever.
Yeah.
So whether it was Slayer, whether it was Megadeth, whether it was King Diamond, Merciful Fate, one of my favorite bands from Germany called Creator, everybody found something.
Yeah.
That night when I signed Metallica to Elektra, Atlantic Records wound up signing Raven, and Island Records wound up signing Anthrax. So everybody kind of made out beautifully in the end.
Yeah, that's, wow. I think that you, because you have such a, like an artistic mind, because we'll get to that too, because you have an artistic mind, you were able to see beyond like, oh, they rock. It's so much more than that. Like, you're seeing people that perform, you're seeing people that can give a show. It's so much more.
Well, that was the beginning. Once we signed them and the records were on a selling and they were on a roll,
yeah.
I kind of felt confident in my job in knowing that I know how to spot people who are that creative and mm-hmm. that unique and that I hope would make a difference in the world.
Yeah.
Of music.
And they did.
Yeah.
With everyone that you've ever done this with. In the documentary, you see Cyndi Lauper a few times. And I wanted to ask you, because it's not totally, I guess, transparent. I'm sure it's in your book. But, like, can you tell me a little bit about that relationship? Can you tell me a story about Cyndi?
I totally adore Cyndi. I saw her with Blue Angel when I was booking the Ritz. Nice. That was my first job in the music business from 1980 to 1983. I was the assistant booking director at the Ritz, and her band Blue Angel played there. Mm. We saw each other. We said hello, goodbye, and blah, blah, blah. Her manager, Lisa Barbaris, was our publicity person, both at Elektra Records and Geffen Records. I was very close with Lisa and still am, and next week I think we're having lunch.
Aww.
She's managed Cyndi for a very, very long time. Yeah. So I worked at record companies up until 2005, and then I just became independent. I became a photographer. I put out 3 books, or this company, Bruno Gmunder in Berlin, put out the 3 books. But I still knew I wanted to do A&R. Mm-hmm. And so it's 2009, and Cyndi called me and said, you know, I love how you work as an A&R person, and I want to make a dance record. Will you make that record? Will you A&R that record for me? Absolutely. I love Cyndi. I have so much respect for her mm-hmm. because not only does she make pop records, she veers off on all these tangents.
Yeah. She did Kinky Boots.
Well, she wrote that. It was beautiful. You know, it's incredible. Yeah. Incredible. So in 2009, we made this dance record called Bring It to the Brink. And it did okay, I think. And then she called back in 2010. And she, in that voice of hers, she was like, Michael, you know, I won't try to imitate her, but she's totally fabulous. you know, Michael, I want to make a blues album. Have you ever made a blues album? I said, no, Sin, I never made a blues album. Have you? No. I said, we're on an even playing field. But I would love to do this with you. I'm honored that you even asked me. So I'd go up to her home up on the Upper West Side, and we'd sit in her kitchen and eat Chinese food. And we would go through stacks of blues recordings, albums, CDs. We would go on our computer and look online. Now, of course, all of these blues songs had to come from a woman's point of view, mm-hmm. or at least I thought so. So we were having a good old time in her kitchen. There was a label that called Cyndi and wanted to make this record with her. So we found her a fabulous producer named Scott Bomar. He lived in Memphis, and a perfect place to make a blues recording. And we got every great session musician from Isaac Hayes' band, Al Green's band, and we made this extraordinary blues album. It's called Memphis Blues, and it got nominated for Best Contemporary Blues Album for a Grammy in 2010. We didn't win, but that's okay because it indicated to us that we did a fabulous job making the record. Yeah. Now, there's a very long story that goes along with that, but I tell it in my book.
Yeah,
I am Michael Alago. And the chapter is called Memphis Blues. And it's really a fun chapter because we also go into civil rights and what the city of Memphis is like. Yeah. And we talk about both civil rights and the music. So it's really very interesting, that chapter
lovely.
In the book. Yes.
That's so good.
So anyways, that's why Cindy's in the movie because of that reason, because I adore her. We love working with each other. And what an incredible artist.
Being
you know?
Two peas in a pod. Like, I would love to be sitting on a bench where you guys are having
we
tea.
Have fun. We laugh. Yes, absolutely.
It's, I think that if you had never seen your documentary and you just looked at your resume on paper, the image of you would be so different to me. Like, I picture this, like, rough and tumble, kooky, like, the big rock guy that I see at Slayer shows, that I see at, like, Crew Fest and all these things.
Yes.
And then I, like, hear you and I'm like, oh my gosh, like every word that comes out of your mouth, I just like want to keep listening for some reason. It's just like so like
well, addicting. Well, I am sometimes rough and tumble.
You are, yes.
You know, I think what surprised Metallica the most when I went backstage at Roseland was that I was not an executive in a suit.
Right.
You know, so they looked at me and Lars had to tell the other three guys, that's Michael Alago from Elektra. Mm-hmm. And they were like, whoa. Because, you know, they were maybe 21 years old. I was 23, 24.
Right.
And so, yeah, I was never a suit. And I think that's why many of the artists, when I went to see them and approached them, we were all almost the same age. I understood where they were coming from. And they related to, like, how I operated.
You were, like, young and cool and you listened.
I was out every night.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's just amazing to, like, even picture.
If you look at my resume, it does speak to who I am.
Yeah.
But it's a little different once we start talking, you know?
I just love hearing your stories because I think that's... It just informs itself so much because if you look at, okay, this guy, signing Metallica, going to CBGBs, going to, you know, all these things, and then you look at some of the latter part of your music resume, and then I see Nina Simone, I go, hold on, who the fuck is this guy?
Well, also, nobody, you know, going to these concerts, nobody thought that a young gay Puerto Rican from Brooklyn was the executive who signed pen to paper Metallica.
Yeah.
And there I am, and there I went, and here we are.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Can you tell me, because you do reference it in the movie, so people should watch it, especially for that part. But can you tell me a little bit of a story about your special relationship with Nina Simone? Can you?
Sure, of course. And funny enough, again, and I will tell you a story, but I think Nina gets so much attention in my memoir that's coming out. I think there's 20 pages about her in there.
Oh, well, then
including an insane letter or two that she wrote to me. I love Nina Simone. I still think she's the greatest artist that walked planet Earth. My Aunt Jenny used to listen to, when I would go visit my dad's sister, my Aunt Jenny in Brooklyn, she had records on like Isaac Hayes, Shaft, The Best of Nancy Wilson, and Nina Simone in concert. And when I heard that voice as a 14, 15-year-old, it had a very androgynous feel to it.
Yes.
And I had no idea at first, but it spoke to me. Mm-hmm. The tone of that voice spoke to me.
Right.
Fast forward, as a little bit older person buying albums, I bought a lot of her records. And I just thought, wow, she speaks volumes to me, even though a lot of those songs she didn't write. So when she does Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues by Bob Dylan, or she does Here Comes the Sun by George Harrison, she gets to the heart of the matter of a song where you think, oh, she must have wrote that. But she didn't.
Yeah.
She just was a great interpreter of other people's material. We had a hoot when we got together.
Yeah.
But don't get on her bad side. Yeah. Because it was not pretty. I tried not to get on her bad side. We really got along because I think she knew that as a young executive, which is where it started out as the relationship, she knew I had so much love and respect for her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she just loved that. Yeah. So we became friends. I followed her all over the world to see her perform. I thought then she was the greatest artist known to man. I mean, I don't want to give away too much.
No, please don't.
I remember one night she was doing 9 nights at the Village Gate or 10 shows at the Village Gate, 2 shows a night, 5 nights. And I remember one night... I went and I screamed because I was a little out of it. Perform Baltimore, which is a Randy Newman song and the title of her record on CTI. She stopped the entire show. She looked directly at me and I thought, oh no, she's going to start yelling at me. She said, listen, we don't do Baltimore. When Creed Taylor gave me $10,000 to make that record for CTI, I never saw another dime. And he's lucky I never put a hatchet in his head. So, Michael, we don't do Baltimore. And she just went back to the piano and started playing and went into the next song. So there are so many little stories like that and better that I tell in my memoir. But that's a little story. And, you know, I also spoke to her in April of 2003, the day before she died. And I talk about it in the book as well, but it was really very emotional and very, very sad for me because we were friends, 18, 19, 20, almost 20 years.
Wow. Yeah.
And it was 10 years before I even signed her to Elektra in 92, 93. And we made a beautiful record with a 50-piece orchestra called A Single Woman.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. So long-winded once again,
no,
but I answered your Nina Simone question.
And also,
I could go on for another hour about Nina Simone, but I won't.
That's its own audiobook.
Oh, please, I wish. Yes, exactly.
Are you going to record your book?
Well, say a prayer,
okay.
And you say a prayer as well, both of you. I do want to do an audiobook. I think it would be so much fun.
I think it would be great.
And people like when I tell stories, so I am going to ask the company about considering an audiobook.
Yeah.
Sure.
I think you absolutely have to do it.
Oh,
so there you go. I absolutely freak out when it comes to singing harmonies. I hear someone sing a different note than me, and I assume I'm wrong. I've always looked for a better way to train my ear and give myself more confidence in my harmony singing ability. Now I get to tell you about my new go-to app, Harmony Helper. Playbill features writer Ruthie Fireberg calls Harmony Helper a lifesaver for auditioning actors. Broadway Con star and Harmony Helper artistic advisor Rob McClure has called the app a game changer for the musical theater industry. Harmony Helper will help you develop the skills to harmonize using the newest tech available. With Harmony Helper, I can literally scan a sheet of music with the camera on my phone, and the app does some kind of witchcraft and maps out the harmony parts. It converts each line of music to audio, allows you to control the playback volume for custom control over your learning process, and then this is the crazy part. It provides real-time feedback to let you know if you're singing your part correctly. Take the rehearsal room into your own hands with Harmony Helper. Download it in the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Can you tell me a story, and you're feel free to be like, no, but I grew up in Georgia, and so people were very into like Reaganomics, people were very big fans of Nancy, and then cut to me getting older, me realizing what all of that meant, me realizing like that Rent wasn't just like a fun musical that I really liked, it was so much more, and then also cut to me seeing things like Angels in America, mm-hmm. Normal Heart, like mm-hmm. all these things. And I go, oh, this was so much bigger and I didn't know anything about it. Why didn't I know anything about it?
But isn't that great that at some point you found all this out?
Sure.
And you went to it.
Yeah.
How marvelous that is, just to broaden your own horizons and be able to speak beautifully about these shows
yeah.
to friends and maybe not family, but to friends and, you know.
Yeah. But I just, and then I see parts of your documentary and I go, can you just tell me a little bit about living in New York during that time and like what, how that, you know, changed you? Just like being in New York with the AIDS epidemic and
okay,
I had
sure.
no idea.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I've always been an open book. Mm-hmm. I always do my best to be my best and tell the truth. I was never in the closet. Never knew, you know, like there's a saying, like closets are for clothes. They are.
Yes.
It wasn't for me. I just didn't know about that mm-hmm. because I just always thought if you didn't like me, too bad. Don't be my friend. You know, don't talk to me. So thank goodness I always grew up either my first 18 years in Brooklyn mm-hmm. until I moved into the city. And I'm 60 now. And wow, I've experienced so many things living in New York. Thank God I lived in New York with yeah. our both Democrats and Republicans.
Sure.
And I don't know what you want me to tackle right now, but I think you had asked me about the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah.
Well, being a young gay man living in New York in the 80s, I found out that I was HIV positive. And for a very long time, I was asymptomatic, which meant I didn't have any symptoms. Mm. But it was very, very scary because a lot of the men that I knew were getting very sick very quick. Mm. Whether they got this thing, I believe it's called MAC, where their eyesight, they were losing their eyesight, or where they got Kaposi sarcoma, which were all of the lesions all over their body. Mm-hmm. I had so much fear that I would get that and more. I never got any of that, thank God. But at some point, probably 7 or 8 years later, in the early 90s, I did have full-blown AIDS, and there was no medicine. Yeah. I always tell people these days when I'm asked in an interview, if you've seen the movie Dallas Buyers Club,
yeah.
it was like Dallas Buyers Club. Everyone was so, oh gosh, urgent to try to find something. Was there a
like,
cure?
Oh, I have this medicine. It might work. Like, it, my friend took it, da-da-da-da.
Right, exactly.
It seemed like people were just grappling to...
Oh, yes. We were desperate.
Yeah.
We were hurting. We had so much fear in the gay community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, are you allowed to touch someone? Are you allowed to kiss someone? You know, like I remember in the 60s and 70s, people were, don't sit on that
toilet seat. Yeah.
You know? And people are like, well, do I have to wear a mask when I speak to you? You know, it was wild. It was very sad. It was very scary.
Yeah.
For people inside and outside the gay community, in any event. When I got sick in the early 90s, there was no medicine yet. And my doctor, who's brilliant, Barbara Starrett, she was on the forefront of being in the laboratories and just about medicine in general. Mm-hmm. And when she wanted me to go to St. Vincent's Hospital, mm-hmm. I said, you know what? That will be my death. I'm not going. Mm-hmm. She didn't like the idea that I wasn't going. But I had incredible health insurance because I worked for Time Warner. So I just lied on my sofa for about a year, and I had nurses come and take care of me. And at the very beginning, Barbara gave me IV vitamin drips. We didn't know what else to do. There were these pills
right.
that came from Mexico. What were these pills? I have no idea. Yeah. Take them. It might help. Well, for me personally, it didn't hurt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my doctor was so amazing that before she made her rounds every day at St. Vincent's, she would come to my home on her bicycle at like 5 o'clock in the morning just to check on me. And that alone just gave me so much hope
yeah.
that I had this extraordinary person looking after me.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, there was this medicine called AZT,
mm-hmm.
and Barbara didn't want me to take it. I said, you know what? You've kept me alive this long. I'm not going to take it. But what it was prematurely approved by the FDA.
Gotcha.
And what it wound up doing is they gave you a little, didn't work. Gave you a lot, it killed you.
Yeah.
So all of the men, mostly men that I knew, it killed all of them. So I was, I don't know if the word was thrilled, but I was happy that I listened to Barbara and I didn't take it.
So thankful.
Thankful. So something I think was called Sequinavir came out. It was FDA approved. I took it. I think I was better within the year that my T cells went up.
Mm-hmm.
My immune system was not as bad as it was during that whole year of me lying on the sofa hoping that I wouldn't die. I went back to work at Elektra. You know, quietly people talked like, you know, Michael has AIDS. But you know what? I was up on my feet. I was so skinny that it was horrible. And I was back at work. I didn't ever get full blown again, but there's so many things being positive that mm-hmm. one gets during the course of the years that, you know, at least I stayed alive and I take lots of medication. And you know, in the winter time, my lungs are shot, so I always pray that the bronchitis doesn't turn into pneumonia. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But you know what? Here we are in 2020, and I'm kicking.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful that I'm alive, and that if through this podcast or other podcasts or writings, I can impart some wisdom on people that. It's not a curable disease yet, but if one takes proper care of themselves and stops the shenanigans of the drink and the drugs or whatever, mm-hmm. you too can have as big a life as you want.
Yeah.
A healthy life.
And you're doing that.
So like, I do it.
You're the way that you've shifted a little bit out of music into like this photography
sure.
world. Can you just like tell me a little bit about that? Because it's so cool to me. I think uh-huh. it's great.
Well, I, besides loving music, I always loved photography. Mm-hmm. I was a nerdy little kid. If I went to someone's home, I always wanted to see what their family albums looked like.
Huh.
Because, I don't know, I just love the idea mm-hmm. of looking at pictures
yeah.
and see what kind of stories those pictures told.
Right.
Fast forward to being an adult. After my 25 years of working at record companies, I thought to myself, you know, I'm going to be a photographer. Whatever. So I became a photographer. And, you know, it's almost like shoot what you're attracted to. So yeah. I was attracted to scarred, muscular, tattooed men.
Yeah.
So that's what I shot. Scarred, muscular, tattooed men. A company called Bruno Gemunder in Berlin saw a little book I put out through the grace and thankfulness of this man, Mike Gallagher, who had a paper collectibles store. And he said, you know, I'm straight, but you really take a good picture. Here's $5,000. See what you could do with it. So I found a company in Canada. I made a little 65-page book called Rough Gods, mm-hmm. and it was men and flowers and please, whatever. And word of mouth, I wound up selling out all 2,000 copies of it. So the people in Berlin found out about the book and they signed me to like a, I think it was like a 2-book deal. And so I made these 2 books of male erotica. One's called Brutal Truth and the other one's called Beautiful Imperfections. And so I have 3 books out of male erotica.
It's awesome.
So they didn't go out of business, but they don't distribute books like they used to anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know when, but I'm gearing up because I do want to do a portrait book, mm. black and white, that of images that I just take on the iPhone with the Hipstamatic application. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all those pictures come out as a square.
Right.
And I love anything in a square. So this next book that I hope to get out, maybe in the next 2 years or so, has really nothing to do with erotica, but it has lots to do with rock and roll. And so they're really kind of fabulous portraits of tattooed men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I also have to include flowers in there because I love flowers so much.
Aww.
And so I went on for too long already. So
no,
what, I don't
love
even know
this.
What your question was anymore.
No, I just wanted you to talk about your new love of photography. I think
that's
it's fantastic.
My love of photography. I live for pictures. I was even tempted to ask the sheriff here at Hoboken if I could take his picture on the way over because he was so hot. And I just thought, oh, I you know what? I'll do it another time. But I have no idea. Usually I have no problem walking up to somebody and asking if I could please take their photograph. But I just didn't. And
can I be honest with you?
Yes.
I think I know the sheriff that you're talking about because he's hot.
Yeah, he's very
I
handsome.
I see him in Boy
yeah,
a lot,
yeah,
the,
yeah.
the coffee shop.
Yeah, all I had to do was see him walk, and I thought, yeah. Oh, my God, help me, please. Yeah, so, yeah, I take pictures, and this past 2 years, I've been writing this memoir with my friend Laura, so here we are.
I'm so excited
me
about
too.
It. And truly, like, you know, you could come out with a book a year. I think you'd still have books until, you know, the end. You
that
know,
sounds good.
I think you're really good. But, you know, you do 1 year, you do photography, then you do this, and then you're like, okay, back to photography, and then you tell more stories. I think everybody would love that because you're just so charismatic I think you're very beloved, and if people don't know who you are, I hope they do by this book and by this movie and by meeting you. But
by this podcast.
And by this podcast, yeah. Yes. Because I think that people often go, well, I don't listen to that music, so I could never. And I'm like, yeah, but a good story is a good story.
Well, that's why, like I mentioned to you earlier, when mm-hmm. Drew Stone and Michael Alex and I were putting together the movie, we knew it just shouldn't be about music.
Right.
If you're going to talk about me, we have to just broaden the whole base. So like mm-hmm. you just said, well, I don't listen to heavy metal, someone might say, but it's much more, it's about a life. And yeah. it's about, you know, what can happen in a life, mm-hmm. The ups and the downs, and how, and the struggles, and how if you pay attention, and just pay attention, it doesn't have to be about just the downs in life. You can get through it all. And part of the journey is, like I said, taking great care of oneself and mm-hmm. listening and learning and opening yourself up to different things so that everyone who walks away from seeing the documentary mm-hmm. just takes a little bit of something away with them that maybe they could use in their own life.
Yeah, I think, and I also just hear so often so many terrible addiction stories. Absolutely. So when I see your journey and I see all this stuff, I go, there's hope for people. Oh, like, yeah. it just brings so much, like, love into my heart.
I had a terrible alcohol and crack addiction, and, you know, coupled that with HIV, I'm really surprised I'm not dead. For real.
Yeah.
So there is always hope out there, and, you know, when people ask me about how I got sober, I just let them know, you know. I go to 12-step meetings, and it's been a very big help for me.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It makes me so happy. So we've reached this part of the podcast where it's almost the end, but okay. We play this kind of little game called Short Story.
Okay, sure.
Which I don't know if we're able to do.
I was going
to
say, I don't know how if I can tell a short story, but I'll take a breath and let's go.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a word, and you're going to tell me a 2-minute story that reminds you of that word. So it's going to be a random word. And if you're ready, your word is blue.
Blue is a beautiful color. It's the name of a Derek Jarman film that he made when he went blind from AIDS. Blue is the color of a policeman's uniform, who I love policemen, the physicality, and that they are here to help all of us.
Aww. Oh my gosh. Okay. So first of all, shortest short story ever. And it's so good. That's perfect. Thank you. So now you can give me a word and then I'll figure out a story from that.
Okay. It's like password.
It's like password.
The word?
Yeah. The word is?
Money.
Money. Okay, so I remember seeing... Did you ever see Cabaret at Studio 54 with Alan Cumming? Okay, so Money makes me think of when I was, like, seeing that show. We were on the sidelines. We're on the right side. And seeing Alan Cumming just running through the rafters of Studio 54. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I don't have memories of Studio 54 because I'm too young. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there. But I have all these understandings of what Studio 54 was. And then to see him running around and then, like, doing Cabaret... And then we got to go backstage after the show, and we're, like, running through the top. I think it's, like, the bridge part where they've got, like, between both sides of the theater. And then we went back to the top to play with, like, the studio lights. And, like, I know it was kind of, it's a little kooky. I can't tell the rest of that story because it's a little explicit. But it was really, really fun. So Money makes me think about that fun night that I had at Studio 54.
Wonderful.
There you go.
So yeah. How many times do we do this?
Oh, no, that was it.
That was it. Oh, wonderful. Okay,
yeah,
so we both done good.
We both did it.
Absolutely.
So I like it because it kind of gives us an edge off of the intensity sometimes
sure.
of the stories. But, yeah, so I'm going to promote like crazy all of your stuff that's coming out, that's already come out, that's coming out, because I think that people deserve to hear your story.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate
Yeah, so thank you, Michael.
Thanks. So this is the end?
Yeah.
Oh, I wish we could go on another
I know.
Hour.
We could, but they won't hear it.
Teasing. And really, I'm so glad. Thank you for asking such good questions, and I'm so glad that I could answer them very clearly for you. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And one time.
There's more to the story.
The kind of story we need right now.
Stories.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.